My Word. A panel game devised by Tony Shrine and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Pyle and Frank Muir challenge Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden in a game about words, with Jack Longland in the chair.
And we go straight into the first round, which tests their vocabulary. For 2 marks, what's the meaning of the following word? Beginning with Frank Muir. In fact, your word is peripatetic.
It sounds like rather Dickensian word. It sounds like a Sam Weller version of very pathetic. He's a peripatetic man. it means a Greek philosopher under the influence of alcohol made from pears. Moving from place to place.
And, by derivation and in common parlance, Frank...
Well, it means somebody on the hoof. Moving about.
Aldo, yes, it does mean mobile, moving from place to place. In your daily job, I mean, a peripatetic teacher of music would visit perhaps a dozen schools rather than being stuck at one of them. And Frank's quite right about the origin. Aristotle used to teach his students in the walks at the Lyceum in Athens, and the philosophers who followed him were called the peripatetics. 2 marks. Anne Scott James, a holocaust.
Somebody's been having a sort of rave-up with the Greek dictionary. The caustic part means burning, of course.
Yes.
And the hollow part means total. So it means absolutely total burning.
By origin and...
Oh, those sacrifices, I think.
Yep. It is a comprehensive burnt offering. You burnt the whole of the animal on the altar, and hence, figuratively, some perfectly disastrous happening or destruction of life. 2 marks. Dennis Norden, rodomontade.
Yes. I know. I'm just trying to... sort of work it out in my mind. It's one of those words that you accept that you know.
Yeah.
And suddenly on a wireless program an extravagant tirade not noted for any degree of diffidence or modesty.
I give 2 marks to Dennis. It comes from a character in poetry, in fact. Ariosto wrote a very, very long thing called Orlando Furioso, and he had this braggart, vain, boastful character called Rodomonte, and he's crept into the language, as Dennis has illustrated. 2 marks. Dennis Powell, a panegyric.
A panegyric means a very, very great deal of praise, such as is offered to Anne and Dennis and Frank. always deserved, of course. It can, in modern Greece, mean a glorious meeting, a kind of festival, but really it just means a lot of absolutely well-deserved praise from everybody for everybody.
Fair enough, Dennis, you get your 2 marks. But what you said, it came to mean, is I think its original meaning, because it originally meant the kind of eulogistic speech which was fit for a national festival, agora being the market where everybody gathered. 2 marks.
I didn't know about that, but don't tell him.
I won't. Oh, before we go on to the next round, here are the quotations that Frank and Dennis have been given for the last round of all. And Frank, your quotation is, any old iron. And yours, Dennis, is, what you lose on the swings, you gain on the roundabouts. Well, now we have a round of poetical pairings. For 2 marks, will you quote the line or lines to which the following two-word quotations belong, and if you can, identify the poem and the poet. Your words, Frank, are hungry generations.
Hungry
generations
say
bee
the nightingale.
Yeah. It's, it is, in fact, the nightingale, ode to.
Yes.
And it's, no hungry generations tread thee down.
Quite right. It's
oh, yes, it's death, isn't it? Immortal bird.
Born for death, immortal bird.
All right, Keats's ode to the nightingale, the first two lines, I was not born for death, immortal bird, no hungry generations tread thee down. And then all about it being heard by the emperor and the clown and poor Ruth among the alien corn and so on. Two marks. And Scott James, livelier Iris, I-R-I-S, livelier Iris.
Well, something to do with Tennyson comes up here.
Quite right.
Well,
if I start...
Oh, in the spring, a young man
says
he lightly turns the thoughts of love.
Yes. Yeah. It's Locksley Hall, Tennyson. In the spring, a livelier Iris changes on the burnished dove. In the spring, a young man's fancy lightly turns to thoughts of love. All right, you get your two. Dennis Norden, Duchess-faced horse.
Well, I can give you... I can't give you the surrounding, the actual nearby context of this. I can tell you an LP that it's on. It's on one that if anybody's got a record token, if they still call them that, it's on Dylan Thomas's record of A Child's Christmas in Wales.
Absolutely right, yes, yes.
And I can give you another line from it.
Well, let's have that one.
He's got a very fat uncle with braces straining like hawsers and breathing like a brass band.
Well, for knowing something which wasn't actually in the question, I'm going to give you your two marks anyway. The immediate surroundings of that Duchess-faced horse are before the motor car, before the wheel, before the Duchess-faced horse, when we rode the daft and happy hills bareback. Two marks. Dylan Thomas, as Dennis quite rightly says, the poem A Child's Christmas in Wales. How did this fall? Scrannel Pipes. S-C-R-A-N-N-E-L. Scrannel Pipes.
That's Milton.
Yes.
And it is which? Lycidas.
Yes, that's right.
Scrannel Pipes of Straw.
Yes, that'll do. It's Milton's Lycidas. He's attacking various sort of clerics and scholars whom he doesn't in the least approve of, and says their lean and flashy songs grate on their scrannel pipes of wretched straw. The hungry sheep look up and are not fed. Well, now we have a rather different round. This is a round of malicious misogynisms, succinct and unfair comments on the fair sex that have been made by sundry male chauvinist pigs. For two marks, who said or wrote these? The first to Frank Muir. Brigands demand your money or your life. Women require both.
What's unfair about that? Brigands is an interesting word to use, isn't it? Is it one of the Irish phrase makers?
No, it's an English one. He went to nowhere and wrote about it.
Samuel Butler.
That's Samuel Butler, the second one, the one who lived between 1835 and 1902, not the one in the 17th century. And I think this comes from his notebooks, which were, pretty tart, weren't they?
I liked another thing he said in his notebooks. He said that, how kind of God to allow Carlyle and Mary to marry.
Yes.
In which case, only two people were unhappy instead of four.
Yes, that's very typical.
Actually, that line was suggested to him by... He had a curious relationship with Miss Savage, wasn't he?
Yes.
With this charming, sweet lady who sort of fell in love with him and eventually died, and he was mortified and didn't realize that she was in love with him because he wasn't a marrying man. And she actually suggests that. She also wrote to him and said that, I saw Mr. Gladstone yesterday in the street. I waited and waited, but no cab ran him over. She was just as good a writer as he was.
Thank Quebec. Anne Scott-James, your turn. But, oh, ye lords of ladies intellectual, inform us truly, have they not henpecked you all?
It's the not three Gilbert and Sullivan, it's earlier, isn't it?
Earlier.
It's,
sort of, it's Browning, Byron, or Cole Porter.
Well, Byron's a good guess.
Yes, Byron will do.
Don Juan.
Yes, it's Don Juan, and Byron, the first canto of Don Juan. Ye lords of ladies intellectual, inform us truly, have they not infectual? It's a terrible rhyme with intellectual, of course. Two marks. Now, Dennis Norden, women are only children of larger growths. They have an entertaining tattle and sometimes wit. But for solid, reasoning, good sense, I never knew in my life one that had it, or who reasoned or acted consequentially for 4 and 20 hours together.
I think they're rising in a body out there. I like the bit that says, I never knew in my life one that had it. I presume he was rather... I don't know. It's a really boring statement.
A good letter writer.
Oh, was it? Letter writer. Awful Lord Chesterfield.
Yes, it was. Yeah.
Really? Well done.
I expected the comments, but let's get the accuracy as well. Lord Chesterfield, writing to his natural son, Philip Dormer Sanhope, a letter of 5th of September, 1748, two marks.
Chesterfield was once being carried along the road by a chairman, and somebody said, look, there goes a peripatetic.
Good. I wish I'd thought of that before. Dennis Power, when women kiss, it always reminds one of prize fighters shaking hands.
It's American.
It's American?
Yes, it's American.
American.
I think Frank will get it.
It's not H.L. Mencken.
Yes, it is.
Thank you, Frank.
But between them, they've got it. It's H.L. Mencken, who, it had a reputation in writing of being a misogynist. I don't think it was really true. And two marks. Well, then there's a quick round of what I think can be called double definitions. For two marks, what in a single word can be defined by both the definitions I shall give you in each question? Frank, your alternatives are the portable sanctuary of Israelites and or a housing for the heel of a ship's mast.
The housing for the healing of a ship's mast. There's something in the sharp end of a boat called a tabernacle.
That's right. It's the portable sanctuary, or tent, I think it was, of the Israelites carried by them through the desert when they were being led by Moses. And it is also, I think, in the Roman Catholic Church, the receptacle for the vessel which holds the host. And but it's also, curiously, this housing for the heel of a ship's mast. Two marks. Anne Scott-James, a sensation of elation and or a flight of three or more larks.
Oh, we've so often been asked what kind of a
noun of a
bunch sense. Larks
four
go
syllable
in.
Word,
honestly? You know,
yes,
the answer
right.
This round,
yeah.
Do you? Do you know?
Exaltation.
Yes.
Of course,
it's true. Exaltation means the sensation of being elated, but it is one of these nouns of congregation or assembly which were used by those who used to hunt or shoot or fish these creatures. And their name for a flight of larks was also an exaltation. Dennis Norden, a large sherry glass and or a fore and aft rigged, generally two-masted, sailing vessel.
Well, yes, it's got to be schooner.
Yes, schooner it is. Two marks. Dennis Power, a medium-sized, speckle-breasted bird and or a fungoid growth on infants and horses.
Thrush.
Would you like to sort of expound a little?
Well, a bird with a speckled breast. There are several, but a thrush is the one most familiar to us.
Yes.
And I do understand that I'm not very familiar with the complaint that horses certainly do suffer from the thrush.
Yes, and
very badly.
Very badly.
What about human beings?
Well, I suppose they do, since you say so.
Well, they don't have them in the same place.
So?
I wouldn't know where.
Have it so.
Yes, I think I was being a bit unfair there. It is. The thrush, old English, thrishke, I think, and it can be, with a horse, an inflammation at the more or less the bottom end of the leg, the frog on the hoof. But with poor babies and small children, it's a disease which usually affects the mouth and throat. So the horse gets it one end and the baby gets it the other end. No, 2 marks. We come now to the last round and to Frank and Dennis's quotations, and the marks will be awarded on the length of the applause from the audience here in the theatre. And Frank, your quotation is, "Any old iron."
Last April, I was up at St. Andrews University watching the Kate Kennedy procession. And this was a procession of famous people who'd been connected with the university, and particularly Kate Kennedy, who was a woman, 16th century woman. And I thought, this must be unique that a woman should be connected with a university of that age. But it is not unique. I discovered the same thing is happening near me. I live in the poor quarter of Surrey, and I discovered that there was a University of Egham, founded by a woman. I was having tea at a sort of curiosity and junk shop in Egham, and he said, do have a piece of cake, and the door went ting-a-ling-a-ling, and he went to sell somebody a cracked plate, you know. And I picked up what I thought was this French pastry, this mille feuilles, you know, those things with hundreds of layers of flaky pastry, and bit into it. It didn't taste very nice. I realized it wasn't a French pastry, it was an old book. and it was this little-known history of Egham University. It apparently was founded by this Lady Anne Hall, who was an Elizabethan. And she was an absolutely riveting person. I don't know why nobody's ever researched her before. She fell in love at the age of 14 with Sir Radcliffe Hall. And he was a bard. He was about 34, actually. She smuggled her lover in with a clergyman, and they were married secretly in the big house privy. This is an odd thing nowadays, an odd place to be married, but in those days, marriages of convenience were really quite... the young couple then settled in a substantial establishment at Egham, and she kept open house and was a sort of hostess there. And in fact, Shakespeare is believed to have stayed there, and she's believed to have influenced his work. She had a vast bull terrier called Spot, who was incontinent. and after befouling the floor, when Shakespeare was there one long weekend, she opened the door and said, "Out, Spot, out, out." And, which is believed to have had an effect on Shakespeare, and suggested... Spot, in fact, wandered across the old Roman bridge to a village on the north side and befouled that village so much that they renamed it Staines. From there, Lady Anne Hall, her husband then died. He was a gamester. He was always at gaming tables, and one day in his 38th year, he won for the first time and had an apoplexy and died. And she went to Constantinople and Rome, and she travelled, and she wrote voluminous letters, as those women did back home. And these letters were exactly the sort of thing that Elizabeth and her ministers wanted, because they were gossipy letters, and she told where all the officers were, you know, the army, and how many ships were in the harbour. And she became the prime source of secret information to Queen Elizabeth I and her ministers. She was the founder of the British Secret Service, although unwittingly. Eventually, she returned home. She was an old woman. She was 142. And she came home, and she was at the dying queen's bedside. And the dying queen said, Dear Annie, the doyenne of my secret service. And she turned to her ministers, dying, and said, let not poor Annie starve. So in that lovely, sort of warm, simple logic of the Elizabethans, they took her out and beheaded her. That was the end of Lady Anne Hall. But I'm going to revive this and I'm going to start this Lady Anne Hall procession, as they've got it at St. Andrews. And we'll start where the university was. And we'll all be dressed in the various clothes of the people who are famous, you know, from that period. And then we'll all form up in front of the Literary Institute in Egham. And the picture of Annie will be held up. And this fantastic woman, I mean, doyenne of the Secret Service, Queen Elizabeth, dear Annie, Lady Hall. And I will give the toast. And I'll say, with a chant, I will say, lift your glasses, the toast is Annie Hall Doyen, Annie Hall Doyen, Annie Hall Doyen.
The worst collection of historical nonsense I've never heard. So we go on to Dennis Norden. And if you remember, his quotation was, what you lose on the swings, you gain on the roundabouts, which I think is a 19th century proverb. Dennis.
Well, that philosophical maxim, or a slight variation of it, was the first thought that swam up into my mind after I'd finished reading a very comforting but entirely unsentimental book about 30s, 40s and early 50s dance bands called And the Bands Played On, written by Sid Collin. Now, why I call the book comforting was because it cured something that was worrying me. The whole world seems to be filling up with individuals who've never even heard of George Scott Wood and his Six Swingers. Or if they have, they think it's a topless trio. And what all this bred within me was a kind of nervous resentment, a resentment which, I freely admit this, began to express itself in tones of increasing peevishness. People used to dance holding each other. You didn't dance two paces away from a girl. You danced among her. What it all boiled down to was that my emotions had been influenced so much by the swing bands of my youth, I'd now become fixated. In a world of Frank Zappas, I was still grooving on Sidney Lipton. And my subconscious kept saying, one day, it'll all return. The big bands will come back. But, you see, it was exactly that delusion for which Sid Collins' book managed a cure, because what he states very convincingly is that they won't. Their time has gone. That era is past. The one thing that you can't do with the snows of yesteryear is refreeze. However, what Sid Collins is careful to point out is that the particular emotional impulse that those swing bands catered to, that is not being mollified by pop groups. So, knowing that nature abhors a vacuum, what is filling that particular gap? Well, I think I can tell you. Soft porn. Yeah, smut. That same steamy kind of titillation that my age group used to get from Alice Faye's lower lip or a really entwined last waltz, that now comes inside paper covers. You see, what's happened is they've brought in Henry Miller to fill the gap that was left by Glenn. So, for that portion of the population who are anywhere around my age bracket, in other words, roughly halfway between adolescence and obsolescence, all is not lost. Before you draw your old age pension, you can still satisfy your middle age penchant. Because you see, although the big B-A-N-D-S are not coming back, the big B-A-N-N-E-D-S are coming in. Or put it another way, what you lose on the swing, you gaze on the randy bits.
Ladies and gentlemen, by your vote, Frank Miller wins the story, and he and Dillis Power win this week's contest.
Taking part in My Word were Anne Scott James, Dillis Powell, Dennis Norton, and Frank Muir. The chairman was Jack Longland. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the program was produced by Tony Shrine.